Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super happy to be talking with Dr. David Hamilton. Firstly, David, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure and thanks for having me on this. I'm really thrilled.
Well, I really enjoyed our conversation last year for the Trauma Super Conference. So I'm excited to get into this area with you. I think this is such an important piece of the jigsaw that ultimately our relationship with ourselves is really the core influence on all the other relationships in our lives. So I think this is it's a great topic. Just to give people a bit of your background, David is a writer, columnist, speaker, and kindness scientist. After completing his PhD, he worked in cardiovascular and cancer research and development with one of the world's largest pharmaceutical companies. Inspired by the placebo effect, he left the industry to write about and educate in how we can best harness our mind and emotions to optimize our health. He's now the author of 11 books, although I believe you're saying, David, just finished your 12th.
No, just finished the 11th, actually.
I just finished 11th.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
And has appeared as a guest on Sunday Brunch in the UK and CBS Sunday Morning in the US, discussing the health benefits of kindness. David, I'd love to start a little bit with how you got interested in this subject. How does a pharmaceutical researcher become interested in the area of self-love?
I'd started out writing books that cover the mind-body connection. That was my first series of books. And then I had a very powerful experience that really brought to the surface issues that I'd been trying to sweep under the carpet for years. On reflection, maybe it's a male thing, or certainly a male thing from where I grew up. You know, I grew up in a very small village in central Scotland that has a large intake of coal miners and that kind of stuff. So it was very much a kind of, you know, you're a man's man and you've really got to be tough and man up. And that was the overall attitude. So maybe I'd grown up in that type of environment. And I remember I was speaking at a Hay House conference. You know, we're both published with Hay House. And I was speaking at a Hay House conference. And it was in Glasgow, in Scotland. It was a home gig for me, I suppose. And I was the next speaker on after the late Dr. Wayne Dyer.
That's a tough spot, hey?
Yeah. And I was standing at the side of the stage and Wayne was getting a standing ovation and I was next to come on. And I experienced an anxiety attack. And you know, it wasn't because I was nervous about speaking, nor even the fact that it was Wayne Dyer, who was a personal hero of mine. It wasn't really that. It was a sense of feeling that I'm rubbish and who do I think I am? You know, if I could put any words, how I felt, as if there was a voice in my head, if I could put any words, it was along the lines of, who do you think you are? You can't go on after Wayne Dyer. You can't speak at this conference. Half of those speakers at this conference have been in Oprah. You know, you're from a village. You're from Bank Knock. That's the name of the wee village I grew up in. You're absolutely shit, kind of thing. And then, as odd as it might sound, maybe not odd to yourself actually, I had a very powerful visual and emotional flashback, a memory of being at school. Primary school, and I would have been about 6 years old, and the teacher was reprimanding me for not bringing my money in for a school trip. Now, the school trip was it was like 5, 10, 15 pence, you know, something like that. We're talking 1977-ish, so maybe about 10 pence or something. And I forget what the school trip was for, but we were all to bring our money in for it. Now, I didn't ask my mum for the money because my mum and dad were really struggling financially. My dad was working in as a labourer at the time in building sites. And, you know, in Scotland, when the winter sets in, very often, the building trade slows down. And so the newer, more what they used to call casual workers, the ones who just get taken on for short periods of time, would get made redundant coming up to Christmas and rehired in January or February. So every year, this repeating cycle, my dad would get made redundant and, you know, maybe four weeks before Christmas and then get taken on 4 weeks after. My mum was so stressed because there was four kids. You know, I've got three sisters. And it was, my mum would often take these like what you now call payday loans just to cover Christmas time. We had Kay's catalogue, what you'd buy all the Christmas presents on and then spend the whole year paying them up, kind of thing. And there was a more ethical company called The Provident, and a man from The Provi, a collector, used to come every Friday night to our house for years with a lined book. You know, Jeanette Hamilton, my mum, has paid, you know, lined in pencil, you know, £5 or £1, whatever my mum paid back every week. And I remember I came down, I was going to ask my mum for the money for this school trip, and my mum and dad were, you know, they were having a kind of a wee bit of an argument. And then I could hear my mum crying. She was upset and she was saying, well, what am I going to do? You know, I've got to get a new skirt for Leslie for school, and David needs a new pair of trainers, and you know, and how are we going to pay the Christmas presents, and how are we going to be able to feed ourselves? And my mum was just so upset, breaking her heart, because for me, my mum still is the kindest person I'd ever known. I felt so upset that my mum was crying because she felt she couldn't provide for us. And I didn't feel like I wasn't provided for. I thought we had everything we needed or wanted. And I ran up to bed and I jumped into my bed and I was crying for two reasons. First, that I just felt such heart and empathy, for my mum. My mum's crying. I started to cry because my mum was crying. Mm. And then secondly, I felt so selfish, because in that moment, I realised that, you know, every penny, every spare penny my mum would get, she'd spend it on the family.
Yeah.
You know, if mum had an extra pound, the first thing she does is she spends it on the family. Even now, my mum goes to the bingo still with one of her friends. If my mum wins, you know, £20 in the bingo, she'll give us all a fiver. You know, she's still got this thing. She gives and gives and gives. And, you know, and I felt so selfish. Like, whenever I get my pocket money, the first thing I would do, never give a thought for anyone else, I'd run to the shop and spend it all on sweets for myself. And I remember at that moment deciding that I'm going to be like my mum one day. I'm going to be kind as well. I'm going to be that kind of good person. And that was that really set a course for the kind of person that I decided to be from that moment. But you can understand why I didn't ask my mum for the money, because as a six-year-old kid, I didn't know that 10 pence is a lot or a little amount of money. For me, I felt asking my mum for 10 pence or whatever it was, that was, you know, that could have been a week's wages, or that could be my mum's dinner or yeah, my sister's dinner tomorrow night, kind of thing. So I didn't ask the teacher, but the teacher didn't take it well at all. Now, in her defence, I think she was probably just a student teacher or, you know, an exchange. She certainly wasn't there for very long, wasn't very experienced.
And she probably thought you were forgetful rather than there was something substantial behind it.
Yeah. So I don't hold any grudge against her for how she behaved in a moment, that I'll tell you about in a moment, because I think she just didn't have the experience. But anyway, she reprimanded me in front of the class, and she said something like, well, if David Hamilton isn't good enough to bring his money in, then he can stay here and we'll all go on the school trip without him. And she made me stand in the corner. Remember, standing in the corner, taking breath, trying not to cry and feeling sorry for myself and trying to do anything with my mind to stop myself crying. I was doing, like, you know, the five times table and the three times, the hardest times tables, even the three and the nine that I could think of, to try and stop myself crying and feeling sorry for myself. And I looked around and all the kids in the class had been given a yellow badge for bringing their money in. And it was, I don't remember the details of the badge, you know, I was six, you know, but it was like a sunflower or a sun or a smiley face, but it was yellow. I didn't care about the school trip because I'd never been in one. I didn't know what a school trip was. But, you know, the badge, see, when you're a kid and you get a badge, you only get a badge on a special day, don't you, right, on your birthday or something. Yeah. So for me, to my six-year-old brain, the badge meant you're special. So what my six-year-old brain processed that day is all the other kids in the class are special except for me. And that got under my skin, because over all my teenage year, my childhood teenage years, I had this need to prove myself to people that I'm just as good as you. And I, you know, I got bullied a heck of a lot at high school, mostly towards the latter years of my high school. You know, in some part, people thought I was a big head bragger showing off, which I did. But they didn't understand, neither did I at the time, that the reason I was doing that is because I just needed people to like me, to accept me. Right. And what was underneath this is just this drive that everyone's special except for me. So, and that kind of echoed through my life, you know, like a, you know, people say repeating pattern or an echo. And the same sort of circumstances would manifest in my life at repeated intervals all through my teenage and adult years. So wind the clock forward. Here I am at the side of the stage, about to go on after Wayne Dyer. And that's what I'm remembering. you know how
the unconscious amazing though that it found exactly the piece that explained how you were feeling in that moment,
isn't it? That, you know, sometimes I think sometimes you remember times in your life more clearly when you felt exactly the same way you feel right now.
Yeah.
And right now at that moment my child brain was running the whole show, and in my to my six-year-old brain that was now running the show at the side of the stage, everyone, all these other speakers are special except for me. Wayne Dyer's got a yellow badge. So has Louise Hay, right, who was also speaking that day. So has Cheryl Richardson and Brian Weiss and Robert Holden and Greg Braden and all these other speakers who were speaking throughout the rest of the day. They all had a yellow badge except for me. And I felt sorry for myself. I felt like crying. I literally wanted to grab hold of the curtain, lie on the floor and cry. And if it wasn't for the fact that the event director was walking and announcing my name and someone else put their hand in the small of my back and ushered me on stage, I just wanted to run away and cry.
Right.
And that was the day I decided that I had been putting off dealing with this issue long enough. And I knew it was to do with self-love. And I had to, you know, self-love and self-esteem are two different things. I think I had outer self-esteem, like I'd achieved a lot in my life. So you have the things that you could pin on, look at what I've done. That's out external self-esteem, but that's not inner self-esteem, which is more self-love, which I define as an inner sense of worthiness and value. And I had very little of that. And that's what I realized on that day that I have to address. And I decided to write a book after that, because I thought if I don't, then I won't really do the work on myself.
But it's also interesting that you, in a sense, had become an expert in kindness and in some ways giving to others what you hadn't yet learned to give to yourself, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly that. And so, I didn't even know how to. I didn't even know what that looked like. I'd never read a book on self-love. I'd managed to somehow not be in the audience every single time there was a talk on self-love. Like, I'd spoken at quite a few Hay House conferences. And whenever, you know, even Louise Hay would speak on self-love, I somehow manifested that I couldn't be in the audience at that moment. You know, I'd be there for some of it, but then I couldn't be in just at the point because maybe I had an interview to do or something else happened or I got distracted, but somehow I missed all of the stuff I needed to hear on self-love until that moment at the side of the stage when I realized that I have to deal with this now.
And just to broaden this then out a little bit towards the relationship piece, what do you see as the relationship between self-love and being able to love others?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we hear this phrase, you can't love another unless you love yourself first. And that's almost become a cliche. I don't think it's quite as clear cut as that. What I would say is when you love yourself fully, you've got more space in your heart and mind. It's not that you can't, if you're not loving yourself, it's not that you can't love someone else, because you can, but what things get in the way, you know, issues, you respond, the way you respond to things, the way you communicate sometimes. So these kind of color things and, you know, they just get in the way, so to speak. So when you learn to love yourself more fully, you just clear away some of the clutter, some of the debris, and there's just more space available. There's more of you available. It's not that you can't love someone else if you don't love yourself, because it isn't quite as black and white. I think there's a scale of, you know, of no self-love to quite a lot kind of thing. So I think as you move up through those stages, I suppose, I call them the three stages of self-love, then there's just more space available in your heart and mind to give to someone else or to allow someone else in.
And it's interesting the distinction you made between self-esteem and self-love, or to put it in some slightly different words, one can have an almost overinflated sense of themselves, perhaps compensating for a deficiency, but to others it may be almost they like themselves a bit too much. Like it's almost like something we would criticize.
Yeah.
But often that's also a sign of ultimately of deficiency, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Because I would say that, you know, you have external self-esteem and and then you have internal self-esteem, which is more what we might call self-love. And external self-esteem is when you build your sense of worthiness and value out of events and circumstances of your life, things that you've achieved, positive things that have happened, even positive things people say about you. So you almost derive your sense of worthiness and value from all these external things. But, you know, a line we've got where I grew up is, you know, if that's all you, the only type you have, then as they say in Scotland, your coat is on a shaky nail.
You know, you hang your coat. I've heard that. That's great.
Your coat's on a shaky nail. You know, come out and fall down. So, you know, because all you need is, you know, a failure or a bad review, opinions to change, and it's devastating. It kills you. You know, it's so, you know, it's devastating. So what you need is an inner sense of worthiness and value, where your sense of worthiness and value comes from the inside. It doesn't mean that you don't want to succeed in your life, and it doesn't mean that you don't want to achieve things, and it doesn't mean that you don't want people to like you. I think that's human nature. It just means that if things change in the outside world, you've got that something on the inside, a kind of like a resource, a resilience on the inside that knows that, you know, no matter what's happened out there, I've got this, and it's everything's going to be okay, and I'm still here, kind of thing. And it's just that switch from out there to in here. And that's why I call it an inner sense of worthiness and value, which I would then expand into saying that's how I would define self-love, you know, which takes in self-compassion as well.
Yes, yes. And so you came off stage at this event, and you'd made this commitment to yourself that this was, in a sense, the next chapter on your own inner journey. What were some of the tools or some of the insights that you discovered that helped you do that inner work?
The first thing was kind of accidental, and it was just after I finished the book, which I had. It turned out to be the longest writing project I've ever taken on in my life. But I agreed with my publisher, with Hay House, that I would get this book done, and my deadline was the 30th of June, you know, a few years back. And I submitted the book, and then Michelle Pilley, the MD of Hay House in the UK, asked if we could have a wee meet for a wee cup of tea. And I thought, maybe.
This is either really good or not so good.
Yeah. And we sat down, and Michelle is a wonderful person, and also very honest and very helpful. She's trying to help all the time. And she said, you know, we all love you in the office. That was the opening line. But I just can't accept this book as it is. Because if we were to publish it as it is, it would be damaging to your career. That's what she said. With hindsight, looking back on reflection, the book was so weak and so didn't have any substance at all, because I had written a book on self-love in my head.
Right.
Doing the way that I had written some of my books prior to that, by just researching through scientific psychology and medical journals and pulling out facts and statistics and stuff, cerebral stuff.
Yeah.
And that, it was on that day I realized that you can't write a book on self-love without the experiential part. You need to know what you're talking about. You know, because you either write a book in one of two ways. You either write a book because you've got the experience, like 10 or 20 years experience, and you're writing from experience, or you're writing it as you're going along and you're learning as you're going along. But you can't write it, that kind of book, from your data, from your head. And Michelle was so nice to me. I actually remember crying in front of Michelle, because it suddenly realized that all the stuff was coming up, and Michelle was absolutely brilliant. She says, look, no deadline. Something a publisher would never say, right. But Michelle said, no deadline. You take as long as you need to write this book. And, you know, even take a break from it and come back to it when you feel like it. And then when you feel it picking up again and you've got a better idea of when we might finish it, then let's talk again and we'll schedule in the publication. And all that was amazing. And on that day, I had this insight. I think of it as the acceptance paradox. The moment you accept yourself, you spontaneously change. If you're trying to get to somewhere by saying, I'll be happy when, or, you know, I'll be happy when I've lost weight, or I'll be happy when I've got that amount of money, then you're putting the happiness at an end point somewhere over there. And what the acceptance paradox, I call it, is the moment you accept, you know, I'm not there yet, I'm just here, you spontaneously change. And so complete acceptance leads to spontaneous infinite change, if you will. And in that moment, I just accepted, you know what? I've been working on this book for 6 months and I've learned nothing at all. And that was the realization. So I was partly crying. I've realized nothing. I've learned nothing. You know, I can't write a book, that kind of book, the way I've written other books. I've got nowhere. And I just accepted where I was that, yeah, I don't know anything about self-love at this moment at all. I've got no experience in it. I don't even know where it's like trying to imagine a color that doesn't exist. I had no practical experience of even knowing what that felt like. But in that moment of acceptance, I sort of knew what I could do. And I sort of knew where to go. The answers started to come to me, not immediate enlightenment. I know all about self-love, but I know that I can find a way. And I know I can feel it. And over the next few months, I started to uncover tools and strategies. And the first one, which was life-changing for me, which actually had a strong basis in what I knew about the mind-body connection, but this was more about the body-mind connection. You know, you can use your mind to affect your body, but what few of us realize is what you do with your body also affects your mind.
Yes.
And I'd always thought about it as the mind affecting body, and I hadn't realized it goes the other way. And I came across some research by Amy Cuddy, you know, at Harvard on the power pose. You know, you stand like Wonder Woman or Superman. And there's lots of other researchers done something kind of similar since then and even before then about posture. But realizing that by the way in which you hold and move your body can impact how you feel. And it'll impact your brain chemistry, your internal body's biochemistry, quite radically away from if you adopt what you call a high power posture, then that will tilt your biochemistry away from stress and towards more self-confidence. And I start to practice it every day, but I went a little bit further and I thought, I know from practice, you know, from visualization that whatever you repetitively do, whether it's a mechanical movement or visualizing, your brain doesn't distinguish between whether I'm moving my hand 150 times or visualizing my hand moving 150 times. The brain will wire it in to an area called the motor cortex in exactly the same way to almost the same degree. And I thought, what if I just catch myself every day as I hold and move my body while I normally respond in a non-self-loving way, a way that I call I'm not enough. I got that line from Daring Greatly, Brené Brown, lovely book, Daring Greatly. It was a great inspiration for one of the chapters in my book, actually. You know, and she talked about I am not enough. And I thought, well, I feel not enough a lot of the times. I didn't realize it, but I meet the world in that way and I meet people in that way a lot of the time. And noticing that a lot of times I would curve my shoulders in or step back, you know, almost put my head down in a submissive kind of way, my voice would drop and go deeper and all these different things. And I thought, every time I do that, I'm wiring that into my brain. So my brain, whenever I into a situation, my brain is just processing learned habits through wiring. I thought, what if I don't do that anymore? Then through neuroplasticity or the reverse of it, all that wiring will begin to rescind and fade away. And what if instead what I replace it with is training myself to adopt a posture, a way of holding my face and my neck, my shoulders, even my vocal cords, even how I speak, the tones, the rate at which I speak. And if I even adjust my shoulders and my back and just literally figure out how will I hold and move my body if I've got this, if I can feel I've got this, I have an inner sense of worthiness and value. And I was relentless with that. I practiced it for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes every morning. I caught myself, you know, pinging my phone every hour kind of thing all throughout the day. How am I holding my body right now? Even I'm standing in the queue at Starbucks, for example, instead of sitting like that, you know, reading my phone up, I'd stand back, hands in the pocket, just a posture that says, you know, I have an inner sense of worthiness and value. So I'm taking those words and I'm wearing them. Mm. I have an inner sense of worthiness and value. And I'm saying, how would that feel in my body right now? So what would my body be like right now if I have an inner sense of worthiness and value? And knowing that as I'm doing this, I'm now wiring brain circuits so that that posture becomes a habit and the old wirings begin to fall away. It's like you've got a wheat field and there's a path that's been worn right through it. That's the way things go in the brain. But if I stop walking in that path, it will quickly overgrow. But what if I'm laying down a new path now? And this new path is, I've got this. I have an inner sense of worthiness and value, or I am enough. and I wear that. And what happens is after a little bit of time, there's a tipping point and the new path becomes more definite than the old one. And I noticed after a couple of months that I was starting to feel a way I'd never felt before. I was starting to meet circumstances and conditions in a way that I've not met. I hadn't pre-planned them. I was just responding to people and circumstances in a brand new way. And for me, that was a game changer. It was the first of two major jumps that I made.
It's interesting as well, because there's obviously the postural piece of how moving your body is affecting your mind and emotions, but also, in a sense, the discipline that it takes to do that is also its own act of self-love, isn't it? It's almost like saying, I care about myself enough that I'm going to do this thing that's actually quite difficult to keep remembering to do.
Yeah, because for me, it was I went through a little psychological process I think of as leverage. And I say, you know, what might the consequences be to my mental and physical health and the evolution of my life and my relationships if I were to keep going the way I've been going and do nothing about this issue? Mm. Then question number two, what might things be like? What could things potentially, and I allow my mind free rein to wander, if I was to start working on this and see it right through to completion? And I think of that as leverage, and that for me gives me the motivation to keep doing the work that needs to get done.
Yes.
And that for me, it was such an important, I realized the absolute importance of it. And I had to keep coming back to those two questions, keep reminding myself over and over again, the importance of doing that.
Yes. And you mentioned that working with your body in that way was the first of two major turning points. What was the other one?
Oh, the other one was it was painful at the time. I think embracing, I know it's a bit of a cliche now, but embracing the power of vulnerability, but that was thrust upon me. I'd made great gains, huge gains in self-love, self-confidence, self-belief, everything through just working on my posture. And that's the main thing I'd done. I'd done a few other things, but that was the main thing. And then my dog got sick. He was still a young dog. He was only, at the time, he was only about 18, 19 months old, a Labrador, Oscar. And we were at the vet. He was getting a CT scan. We thought he'd maybe, a ligament thing, or maybe at worst, maybe even had a fracture on the knee side of his left hind leg. And the vet came back and said his words, I'm very sorry to say, he has osteosarcoma, bone cancer. There's nothing you can do. He has about, at best, 3 months to live. There's nothing you can do. It's not your fault. If it would be easier for you, he's under anaesthetic just now, we can just give him an extra dose and let him go.
Wow.
And even saying those words now, I still feel emotional. And the ground just fell away, because he was our boy. You know, we didn't have any human babies, you know. So my partner Elizabeth was there, and we couldn't take it in. And then she just openly wept, and I did as well. And I tried to kind of deal with it, because he was like the king of our house. You know, he was the boss, really. You know, I thought when we got a dog, you know, I'll be the master. You know, he taught me so much about self-love. You know, I'll be the top of the tree. And, you know, I was actually the third in the pecking order. He was the boss, and Elizabeth and me.
I always tell my wife that there's the kids, there's the dogs, and then there's me right down the bottom.
That's kind of how it was. I thought I was going to be the alpha male, but instead Oscar saw me as the playmate. You know, I was the one he plays with and stuff. So I... But anyway, in that moment of crying, the manning up thing the only thing I knew to do in difficult situations is to man up and not cry, because that's what I learned in that village I grew up in central Scotland. So I just thought, I've got this. I don't worry about it. I know what to do. I know a lot about it. I used to work in cancer research and development. I know I've forgotten more than I ever know. Or something like that. You know, I've learned a hell of a lot more now since then about other approaches in addition to all that. And I thought, I know what to do. So anyway, I phoned my mum and dad. I said, Mum, there's this kind of stuff I gave you a few years ago. I need it back. And why is it, son? Are you okay? No, it's for Oscar, the, he said he's got bone cancer, he's going to die. But my mum's, oh, I'm so sorry, son. Mum, don't worry about it. I've got this. I can solve it. Totally fine. Anyway, got to the house, walked in the door. My mum was standing in the middle of the living room. And as soon as I saw my mum, I just broke down and cried. My mum gave me this great big hug. And I just wept and wept and wept at the fear of losing Oscar. Now it was safe. My mum was there. And then I turned round and I saw my dad sitting in the chair. And my dad, you know, also part of the whole man up thing, he'd learned that as well. And I saw my dad, and the moment my dad saw me crying, he went like that. He just turned away. He didn't mean to. It was an instinct. He didn't, because my dad didn't know how to meet his son in an emotional situation. And he just instinctively turned away. And at that moment, I thought of kind of backing out and manning up. And then I had that little realization that, no, I'm not. That's what I always do. I'm not going to cheapen Oscar's experience by trying to pretend. I will do the best I can for him, but I'm not going to cheapen his life by pretending that I don't feel the way I really do. And in that moment, I thought, I'm not going to hold back. I'm not going to pretend. I'm not going to buckle to the pressure of being manly anymore. I'm not going to buckle to the pressure of being the person who supposedly has all the answers. I remember thinking, you know, fuck it. Sorry for the language, but that's how I felt in that moment. And you know, sometimes when a shift inside yourself is so profound, it's like it sends a ripple out and affects everyone. Because my dad got shifted that day because I went to the front door when I was saying cheerio, and my mum always comes to the door and gives me a hug, and my dad sits in the living room and goes, right, son, see you next week, kind of thing. And but this time my dad came over and my mum gave me a hug, and my dad was kind of almost like there as well. And that kind of developed, you know, over my dad. And Oscar did pass away. We got a leg amputated, but that was one of the ways we tried to save his life. And he passed away after 6 months. He had a really happy last time and spent a lot of good times with him. I remember that waking up the morning after he passed away, and the house was empty. It's funny how when a soul leaves a house, that's what kept the house alive. And it was quiet. It was empty. It was like an empty eggshell. It's hard to describe, but there was nothing in that house. It was a rental. There was nothing in it. It was just empty. My dad phoned me up about 6 o'clock in the morning. And he said, sorry to phone you so early, son. I was just wondering how you're feeling. Now, in all my life prior to that, my dad had never once inquired about my emotional state. And after then, he would phone me in the morning and other times just to check on me. And my dad and I have a great relationship. He hugs me. You know, we hug. Wow. Great. Wow. You know, for my dad, that's huge and stuff. But anyway, but that was part of it. And then the other part of it was a few months later, the book came out. Michelle held the book publication back after Oscar passed away because she said, maybe you should write an afterword because he played such a huge part in writing, you know, my book, I Heart Me. And Michelle says, look, we'll just hold it back. This is more important to you right now. And I wrote an afterword, and Michelle held the publication back, which astonishingly, the date was pushed back a month, and it actually came out on International Day of Self-Love by accident.
Life has its own wisdom, hey?
The day before Valentine's, which is the 14th of February, it came out on the 13th of February. None of us actually knew that that was International Day of Self-Love. It's funny how it worked. Anyway, one of my first talks, it was a Hay House conference, and I was standing on stage, and I was talking about self-love, and then I didn't mean to talk about the vulnerability in Oscar, and I started crying because it just all came up, still really raw and very fresh. And I started crying in front of this audience of about, you know, 700 or 800 people. And you know, sometimes when you feel embarrassed crying and you try not to, so you go
it gets worse and better, doesn't it?
Yeah, it just makes it worse. And at one point I had that little realization. I remember thinking, oh, fuck it, you know. At that moment, I was thinking, if people see me crying, I'm in front of the stage. I'm the speaker. I'm the author. I'm supposed to have the answers. No one's going to buy this book anyway, but no one's going to buy any more of my books. My career is over. If people just think, if he can't even hold himself together to give a talk, he's not bloody good self-help speaker at all. Not interested in him. And I remember that was the pressure I was feeling at the time. I need to be the one that has the answers. And this was the vulnerability part came in. I remember thinking, I'm done with that. I'm actually done with it. You know, I'm not, again, I'm not going to cheapen my experience I had with Oscar and the love I felt for him. I'm not going to do that. I'm from this moment, I'm just going to be myself. And if that means people stop reading my book, it's better if I'm, it's more better, healthier for me and for everyone whose lives I'm part of, if I just be myself, even if that means I'm not a good teacher. Even if that
it,
means
what it is it's the modeling of self-love, isn't it? It's saying I care for me enough to let myself be free.
And I didn't know, I didn't even think of that at the time. I just knew that that was the right thing to do. And I just stood there and I'm saying, I'm really sorry. It was very painful for me. I just cried. I just openly wept then. Mm. And after what felt like an infinity, a woman jumped up on the stage and gave me a hug. And then everyone started clapping. But anyway, me, and it was, then the rest of my talk went really, really well. And funnily enough, me thinking that no one will buy my book, that book sold out in like 3 minutes. In fact, it was the fastest ever complete sellout of a book Hay House had ever had at a conference. Hay House were sending people out to find Waterstone shops in the town and buying up all theirs because they had none left, because they literally sold so fast. Everyone wanted to get it. And that was an amazing teaching experience for me, that your teaching is more powerful when you actually embrace who you are. And it's more about, it was really about saying, this is who I am. I don't have to be a great teacher in the way that I thought a teacher is.
Yeah.
I just have to be myself. That's teaching.
What comes to my mind as you're talking, David, is that both with the postural piece, with the vulnerability piece, that it's ultimately self-love is a practice, right? That you're being committed to showing up to yourself, whatever that means in that moment.
Yeah, it was taking it from things that you say to things that you do, and therefore things that you are. And I never went back after that. That was my commitment to keep showing up as myself. And what was amazing is my career actually expanded from that moment. And when I stopped trying to be what I thought I was supposed to be, having written, you know, half a dozen books prior to that, and then feeling a subconscious pressure to be the teacher. And I just stopped doing that. And I just decided maybe my way of teaching is just to be wholeheartedly who I am, in whatever direction that takes me in. And that's the teaching itself. And I became a better teacher from doing that. And so my relationship with myself dramatically changed over that period of working on that book, really.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. David, for people that want to find out more about you and your books and your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
My website, drdavidhamilton.com. And I'm active on social media. Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. So David R. Hamilton, PhD, is my handle. Except on Twitter, it's Dr. Hamilton. I couldn't get David R. Hamilton, PhD.
Well, you'll have the second doctorate in a few years, so you're...
So, but, you know, my website's pretty much the vehicle for all the... gets into all these things. I write loads and loads of blogs, but loads of videos I do on YouTube and stuff like that. They're all through my website anyway, so...
Fantastic. David, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me to share this conversation.